Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 134 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Gavin. The usual two co-hosts are off this week. We're recording not our typical day, so Mike is off hosting bar trivia, and Fia is, you know, doing PhD things. But fortunately for me, we have a wonderful guest here on the show. One of my friends who started the same time as me at Bucknell University. Dr. Nathan Smith, how are you doing? And thank you for joining us.
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about ants today. And before we get into that, though, do not forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on and to make sure you follow us on the various social medias, Twitter, Facebook, and especially YouTube in order to give us any kind of feedback on the show that you might have, suggest any future topics you'd like to hear about on the show. And if you'd like to be a guest, like Nate, on the show, we have a form down in the show notes that you can fill out to sort of let us know a little bit about yourself. And next week, next week's an episode that ends in 5, so that is not my episode. every episode that ends in a 5 or a 0 is no longer mine to control. So next week, I believe it is a Fia episode, so Fia will be telling us something cool about something the world that she deals in with her PhD or marine ecology, something like that. So with some of that stuff out of the way, this is no longer going to be about me. So Nate, go ahead and introduce yourself and some of the things that you're working on here at Bucknell.
Yeah, so my name's Nate Smith. So I'm originally from Pennsylvania, so coming back to Bucknell is sort of a homecoming for me. But I got my PhD at Arizona State University in the Social Insect Research Group, which is a really large group of people that study social insects. So pretty much bees and ants with one termite person in the mix. So my research interest, my specific research focus is on how groups make decisions. So I work with ants because they're a very complex group. And I make it even harder on myself by studying leafcutter ants, which are ants that farm.
Yeah.
So social farming animals, studying how they choose what to eat is sort of the nutritional biology has been the lens through which I address questions about social decision making.
Awesome. So what sort of drew you to ants to begin with, or social insects, I should say more broadly?
Yeah, sure. So that's a thing for being on this podcast in particular that's a little tricky is that, like, I'm not really an entomologist at heart. I'm a social behavior person who kind of ended up in the ant world. So I know more about ants than 99% of people, but there are real entomologists out there that know far more than me. So I was really interested as an undergraduate student in animal behavior. I kind of knew for graduate school I wanted to look for animal behavior programs. But I actually interviewed, and I knew I liked social behavior. So I had an anthropology minor. I was actually really interested in human social behavior and the evolution of social behavior in general. And in the process of interviewing for graduate labs, I interviewed with someone who studied chimpanzees. I interviewed with a bird lab. I was kind of all over the place in several social insect labs. And I realized that I'm a really quantitative biologist. And it turns out that you can do really mean things to ants and you don't even need any ethical review to do so. Whereas with chimpanzees, if I wanted to study how they chose what to eat, it would be literally watch them through a microscope, binoculars, and then pick up their poop. That's about the extent of what you can do. So that was actually really what drew me to the insect world. And then when I got into the world, I sort of just fell in love with leafcutter ants and their complexity during my time in grad school.
Awesome. Yeah, that's definitely a side of research science that I don't really deal with much being a paleontologist is like, yeah, we deal with a lot of like land and like trespassing and like land use rights sort of thing. We definitely don't deal with what things are okay to do to animals and not. But yeah, I think anybody who gets into grad school should have to take some kind of like research ethics.
Oh yeah, like definitely
geared toward their research. Unfortunately, I think very few people do. But yeah, that's really interesting. And like you said, you're not quote unquote an entomologist, but you know, for the purposes of this podcast, that is, you know, for sure more than adequate. But yeah, so tell us, I guess, a little bit about ants. We see them all the time. We see them, you know, in this part of the world when the weather's nice. You see them every single day, kind of everywhere. They get all up in your food, all up on your counters. But what is an ant?
So ants are incredibly cool. Couple kind of standout characteristic of ants is, so one big thing, one thing that E.O. Wilson, so he's a very famous ant biologist, and he famously said, these days there'd be a debate, but if aliens came to Earth 200 years ago, they would assume that ants were the dominant life form on the planet. It wasn't until the late 1800s that London became the first city that was like a single communal living group of humans that surpassed the size of a bunch of ant colonies. Because you have many examples of ant colonies with, you know, tens of millions of individuals living together in a related kin group in one communal nest. And so they are just incredible. And they've been that way for millions and millions of years. So incredibly complex and impressive animals. Unlike the bees, all ants are eusocial, which is a term that refers to the sort of most advanced level of sociality. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that you would maybe, again, the last couple centuries, humans have finally kind of caught up, but for the vast majority of history, you might have thought ants are the dominant life form, is that there are approximately 10 to the 15 number of ants, and what the actual biomass equivalent of that is, but it's somewhere between 50 to 100% of all modern human mass. So if you take all the ants and all the humans on the planet right now, weigh them all up, ants weigh a substantial portion as much as the humans. So it might be like, I think there was a more recent conservative estimate that was like 20% of the mass of humans, but it's still just a gargantuan amount of biomass. More than like mammals and plants combined. Mammals and reptilia combined. Like all the other vertebrate clades combined.
And that sounds weird just because, A, you think ants are so little. But even just from an ecology sort of standpoint, that kind of makes sense because they are farther down the trophic level, mm-hmm. typically. So, like, ecology-wise, I get that should make sense, but it still feels weird.
It does feel weird. So I study leafcutter ants. In the Neotropics, so in Central and South America, they're the greatest contributor to biomass of all animals. Like, you take all of the animals in the tropics, which is, you know, this famously very species rich, you know, all these amazing animals. I love being there. Highly recommend it to go if you ever get a chance, anyone listening. But you take all of the, you know, the tapirs, the monkeys, everything, add everything up and weigh it, the single greatest contributor is ants. Because like I said, a leafcutter ant colony can have 10 million individuals, and that's one colony, and they're everywhere.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get to see some leafcutter ants in action. What year was that? 2019. I went down to Belize for a trip in undergrad, and we were there for about a week and a half, and one of the places we were staying had a colony nearby that we could just go and watch, and you could see, like, they had their own, like, hiking trails. There were lines in the grass where there just was no grass anymore because the ants either chopped it up or just walked over it like, you know, people do on hiking trails and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it was wild to see because in the day, maybe you can talk about this a little more. At least these, you know, leafcutter ants seem to be a lot less active during the day. So it was like when we were walking around during the day, didn't really see them all that much. But then as soon as it got dark, we went out with some headlamps and it was incredible.
Yeah, they're super cool. I actually, my first year of graduate school, I was a Smithsonian fellow. I wasn't planning on doing research with leafcutter ants, but being in the tropics and just seeing them everywhere and, you know, like, what's going on with these guys was, well, actually gals, they're all female, is what got me into that world.
Yeah, so I guess talking about the different sort of features in ants and what makes ants ants. So you mentioned bees previously. So what makes an ant different than a bee or a wasp, which are some of their closer relatives?
Sure. So the Hymenoptera is a order that includes the ants, the bees, the wasps, and the sawflies.
I always forget about sawflies.
Yeah, they get forgotten about, poor sawflies. They're part of Hymenoptera, but they're just not as charismatic. Ants are terrestrial is like one of the really big differences from those other two groups. They don't fly. The reproductive individuals fly for their nuptial flight, which is when they go reproduce. But through the actual lifespan of the colony, they are on the ground, unlike the bees and the wasps. The fun morphological standout is the elbowed antenna. So that's these days there's a lot of cool internet memes about all of these animals that mimic ants, which are very cool. they're called myrmecophiles. I have friends that study them, and we're realizing how many of them there are, and they're fascinating, and they have all this chemical trickery that they can hide out in an ant colony and not be recognized as something else. But the telltale sign of whether it's a mimic or an actual ant is that elbowed antenna. If they have a straight antenna, they're playing around. They're not legit.
I know one of the ones that I see most often are spiders, because mm-hmm. they can even sort of fake that with their front pair of legs.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's like, man, if even spiders are so, you know, we've mentioned several times, evolution doesn't quite work like this. We've mentioned that a lot in the show, but like, mm-hmm. if even spiders that a lot of other, you know, especially small invertebrates are afraid enough of ants that they want to look like ants to not be messed with by the ants, that's saying something. Flight, you said, is the biggest one. So before we get into sort of the evolution stuff, mm-hmm. you talked about them being eusocial.
Yes.
And so that is what I think hymenopterans in general are probably the most famous for, but ants in particular. So like, yep. what exactly does that mean, and how is that different from some other social, you know, categories?
Sure. So I'll say up front, one problem with the way that we define the types of sociality is that it was all done by entomologists. I know that sounds ironic coming from me, but more recently we're discovering there are these other animals. So for example, naked mole rats.
Yeah, I was definitely going to bring them up at some point. Yep.
Yeah, we have these two species of mammals that actually might meet the definition of eusociality, but they don't kind of, there's debate about how well they meet it, but that's because the definitions are all based on insects. So I just want to say up front that like the way we define the levels are very sure. insect biased. But the key characteristics are a reproductive division of labor. So that means some individuals within a colony reproduce while others do not. That one evolutionarily and in terms of commonality is sort of what really separates eusociality from some of the other levels. The other key characteristics are overlapping generations. So you have multiple generations living, in the same place. And then cooperative brood care. So you have multiple individuals sharing the task of taking care of the developing young. So if you have all of those characteristics, that is what defines the criteria for eusociality.
Okay. And so we can get into this a little later. I have, you know, questions just based on that. You know, mm-hmm. we've mentioned a lot of times that pretty much the only goal of evolution is to have kids.
Yep.
And so if there's only one having kids, that raises some questions about what the other ones are up to.
Yes. It raises a lot of questions, and it's an unresolved question within the study of social insects, to be honest. There's a couple leading okay. hypotheses, but like, the dominant one for a long time, and I don't want to get too into the weeds on genetics, but I think I can explain it pretty simply, was okay. the haplodiploidy hypothesis. So one interesting characteristic of the hymenopterans, which it's been suggested might be why, as you mentioned before, eusociality is the standout characteristic of this group, is their genetic architecture, which it's called haplodiploidy, which means that males in this system are haploid. So they only have one set okay. of their genes, and they are produced by a queen laying an unfertilized egg, whereas the females are diploid. So humans are diploid. Huh. Many yeah. vertebrates are diploid. I mean, we have two sets of chromosomes. We get half of them from our mom and half of them from our dad. In the case of ants, the females have the same genetic structure, but the males just have one set of genes, which they inherit from their mother. And so the genetic sort of fallout of this is that because if a colony has one queen and she mated with one male, each of her daughters is more related to her sisters than to her own offspring, because right. the mother will have a 0.5 relatedness to their offspring, just like we do, because they get half their genes from their mom and half their genes from their dad. But mm-hmm. their father is going to give the exact same genetic information to every of his offspring, because he only has one set of chromosomes. So if you combine up the relatedness, you get the half from the mom and the full half from the dad, and you get 0.75 instead of 0.5. It's a lot easier. I highly recommend, if anyone's confused by that, do a quick Google search of haplodiploidy, because they're the diagrams where you look at the genetic inheritance from each parent really makes it clear. So for a long time, it was believed that the fact that they were more related to their sisters than their own offspring is what drove the evolution. It was a key characteristic for the evolution of eusociality. That's been questioned more recently because it turns out that, you know, the flip side of that is they're less related to their brothers. And since the reproductive individuals that are produced by a new colony are the only ones that are actually going to spread genes into future generations, that it kind of balances out between the two. And so there's still ongoing debate about what, if and what role haplodiploidy actually plays in the evolution of eusociality. But I have to mention that because it's a defining characteristic of hymenopterans, and it's what led our understanding of that for quite a few decades.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's one of those things where it's like, if you were to Google it, I'm sure that would come up. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that is sort of the most mainstream currently supported hypothesis.
Right.
But yeah, I know something that I don't think we've ever talked about on the podcast before is kin selection. And
oh, sure.
How, like, that's people think that might have also been, you know, influential in human evolution as mm-hmm. well. Where it's like, yeah, you know, helping your cousins, you know, you're still sort of related to your cousins. You know, it's not as much as your own kids, but they're still part of your lineage, sort of. And helping them is an indirect way of helping pass on your own genetics.
Yes.
So I feel like that was one of the first things that came to my mind when, like, all of these unreproducing ones helping pass on roughly their genetics a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said that up front. All of that, what that I just said about the haplodiploidy thing is predicated on the idea of kin selection. So the idea is if you are more related to your sisters than your own offspring, evolution would select for you to help your mother have more sisters than for you to reproduce yourself. To help explain it in terms of humans, if you and you have a full sibling, you have the same parents, you on average share half of the same genes with your siblings as you do with yourself. And again, like I said before, because of the mixing of diploid species with two humans, if you have your own kids, they inherit half of your genes. So if you have half of the same genes as your sibling and they reproduce with someone else, your nieces and nephews, your siblings' children, you have a quarter of the same genetics as them, because again, they get half from their mom, they get half from their dad. And if one of those parents is your sibling, if you have the half that your sibling has and you split it in half again, that's 0.25. Right. So the way the math works very simply is like, I have a brother who has two daughters, his two daughters combined are as related to me as if I had one of my own children. So when we talk about kin selection, the idea would be if I performed some behavior that made it so I had one less of my own kids, but I helped my brother have three kids as a direct result of that sacrifice on my part, evolution would select for me to do that because I'm actually getting a greater overall representation of my genes in the next generation. And so again, with haplodiploidy, the idea is if an aunt is more related to her sister than her own kids, that would be a strong selection force for helping their mom produce more offspring and not worrying about their own reproductive output of themselves as an individual.
Right. Yeah. And that's, like I said, we've had several episodes about various aspects of evolution and natural selection. Kin selection has just not particularly come up because in, you know, a lot of it, you know, for groups, especially vertebrates that are not particularly social, there's no reason for that to come up in that conversation.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those things. And this is, you know, showing a little bit of my vertebrate bias here, that this whole conversation we had the last, you know, 5 minutes is part of why I prefer vertebrates. It's just, in my mind, a little simpler.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I teach a class at Bucknell that I developed on social behavior. So kin selection comes up a lot. And I talked about, we mentioned already the levels of sociality, and my students were struggling to think of examples of animals at these different levels. And I was like, guys, you're thinking about mammals. Like, there's so few mammals, like insects. There are more beetles than there are like all vertebrates combined.
Yeah. And that's, and it's not close. There's like 60 to 70,000 total species of vertebrates. And that's including all the fish, sharks, all the way through birds and mammals and lizards and stuff. There's like identified species of beetles, like close to a million, isn't there?
Yeah, something like that.
And that's the ones that we have identified. And nobody thinks that that's particularly close to how many there actually are. And that's just beetles. I've heard similar things talking about hymenopterans, mostly ants, in that same sort of vein as well. And that's also
There's like about 14,000 described species of ants, which is like okay. more than all mammals. Isn't it like 6,000 species of mammals or something like that?
Yeah.
So, yes. That you're right that it's very different to the way that people typically think, because as vertebrates we have that bias, but invertebrates there's so many more of them.
Yeah. And not just that, just the we talk a ton of when we talk about different vertebrate groups and their evolution about which parts of them are like homologous to mm-hmm. parts on ourselves. And all vertebrates have a relatively similar body plan to one another. We're all, grand scheme of things, very closely related. And then you get into the world of invertebrates, and it's, you know, technically, you know, an ant and a clam are more closely related to each other than either is to us, but man, that's not like they look the same.
Well, they've also had a lot more time. That's the other thing to remember with all of this. It's vertebrates are much more new to the game of being living things.
Yeah. Or at least being divergent from one another.
Right.
But yeah, so I guess we're talking a little bit about deep time stuff. So let's talk a little bit about their evolution. So we have talked a bit about insect evolution before, mostly in terms of flight. Just because they do it so fundamentally differently than any of the vertebrates do.
Sure.
So I guess, roughly, where are ants in terms of all the other insects? And what is some of their evolution like?
Sure. So in terms of like how long have they been around? So they first evolved during the Cretaceous. I think our oldest fossils are about 100 million years ago. And then there's some...
I'd be surprised if that wasn't an amber fossil.
Yes, those are amber fossils. Yep.
Yeah, that's kind of the time period when we start seeing widespread amber. And that's another thing with any kind of insect fossils is that, like, they don't hold together particularly well.
Yeah.
So it's... What are some of those first ants like? Are they basically already ants and ant-shaped?
So it's cool. They're interesting. There's sort of these transitions between wasps and ants. So they have some like characteristics of waspy things. I don't think that the earliest ones we have those elbowed antennae yet that are like sort of really defining of modern ants. And they have, I think, some of the sort of abdominal structures more like wasps. If I remember, it's been a while since I looked at that stuff.
Sure.
It's not until around, 80 to 70 million years ago that we start to see some of the modern ant families emerge in the, again, mostly amber fossil record.
Cool. And then from that point, I know anything with insects, when you talk about their evolution, you also kind of have to go along with some of the flowering plant evolution mm-hmm. stuff. That's, you know, starting like early middle Cretaceous, you kind of can't talk about one without talking about the other. So like how is that kind of shaped ant evolution?
Very much hand in hand. So again, just looking at like the fossil record with the, have you guys talked about the angiosperm revolution? If I say that term.
Not directly. Like we haven't had like an individual episode on it per se, but we've had a sort of a little series where we go through each of the, you know, periods, and then at this point we're getting into some of the more recent epochs of geologic time. So we had one about the Cretaceous. We talked quite a bit about, you know, the evolution of angiosperms and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah. So that they very much go hand in hand. So you see huge diversification in terms of species following the evolution of flowering plants and the move of terrestrial flowering plants. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I was making sure I said that right. I was mixing the words, the terms angiosperm and flowering. And so in the Cretaceous, again, like you pointed out, and I'm so glad you said that. This is a thing you'll be proud of. I actually teach a vertebrate ecology class here. I've just given to all the listeners that I'm a total poser in there because I'm actually a vertebrate biologist. But I talk so much about the fossil record and how important it is to our understanding mm-hmm. of how these things have evolved and how they're related to one another. And So with the caveat that it's, you know, the fossil record for the earlier, the Cretaceous is a lot less robust than from later periods. But if you look at the Cretaceous, ants are about 1% of the insects that have been found in that period. And then by the time you get to the Miocene, so past the development of flowering plants, they're like 20 to 40% of the fossil record. So just as you kind of laid out, you would expect, you see flowering plants evolve and you see this rapid diversification and then also this just increase in the prevalence of ants. So they go from being 1% of the fossil record of invertebrates to being almost half of the invertebrates that we have preserved as fossils.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. And there's almost no swing that I can think of like that, that's like that pronounced that I can think of. Maybe the only other one that I can think of off the top of my head is flowering plants taking over the non-flowering plants.
Sure, yeah.
at roughly the same time. But yeah, so that's, I guess, a little bit on the evolution of sort of the ant shape. And this is something that is much, much harder to sort of suss out because behavior is notoriously really bad at becoming fossils. What kind of clues do we have about sort of the timeline of the varying degrees of sociality evolving in ants?
That is a great question. I honestly have not encountered much about that. All modern ants are eusocial, and I think that most of the fossilized groups that we have some evidence that they're eusocial, but I'm actually not as well versed in that. I do know, obviously, with leafcutter ants, so fungus farming, leafcutter ants are considered some of the most advanced social groups of ants because you have, again, up to 10 million individuals living in a colony that's 6,000 square feet. It's like Manhattan, basically, in terms of population and size relative to their bodies. That's a much more recent evolution. That's like 8 to 10 million years ago, or 8 to 12 million years ago, I think.
And is that something that we kind of know from looking at their genetics, or do we have like preserved burrows that you've seen or heard
of? That one is a combination, both the genetics, but also fossil record. Fungus farming is much older, I should say. So fungus farming has been around for like 50 million years, but leaf cutting, there's only 47 species of leafcutter ants. They're the ones that actually cut fresh vegetation to feed to their fungus, and they live in an obligate mutualism with their fungus, meaning neither the ants or the fungus can live by themselves. And so that's a much more recent evolution. But to answer your original question, I'm sorry, I can't remember much I've learned on that front. And as you said, behavior is really hard to capture in the fossil record. My favorite, it can happen though, there was a person who was a postdoc in the social insect group who actually ended up publishing a paper trying to understand the mathematical rules by which groups of fish organized their spatial organization based on a fossil of a bunch of... So he was working in a lab that looked at how ants use simple behavioral rules to solve complex problems. And he found this fossil where there were a bunch of shoaling fish and managed to like recreate the mathematical rules by which they organized themselves based on a fossil. But that's like a very rare, hard to do thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's... that's just one of the major downsides of the fossil record is that behavior is something that it's, you can make some hypotheses about and there can be some evidence leading to certain things, but there are certain things that we're just never going to know, which as a scientist is just fundamentally frustrating.
It's the worst thing. And so my actual PhD is in animal behavior, and behavior is like my favorite thing. It's the through line of all my research. If you do the Venn diagram of my research, it's ecology, nutritional physiology, and behavior, but behavior is the thing that really goes through everything. And as someone, for this podcast, like I was also a huge dinosaur fan as a kid. Yeah. I had a binder where I collected like information about species of different dinosaurs, and the fact that we know nothing about their behavior breaks my heart.
Yeah.
Almost nothing, not nothing, but very little.
Let's see, what are some other ant things that I can think of? So different, species of ants sort of have different roles, I guess. Or maybe that's, maybe I'm a little wrong about that. But the ones that I think of are things like army ants or some that have like the soldiers that are like much, much larger than the others.
Oh, yeah.
So is that sort of a taxonomic thing, or are there, you know, does that evolve independently a whole bunch of times, or?
That's one of the really cool characteristics of ants is morphological caste differentiation is what we call it, to use our more fancy technical term.
Sure.
What Gavin's referring to is the fact that different ants within a colony have different sizes and shapes and body features that allow them to be best at their jobs. And this is really characteristic of advanced sociality. So again, we're talking about this group that is kind of at the highest bleeding edge of social behavior. And one of the things that helps a group be better at working as a group is if different individuals specialize on different tasks. And in the case of ants, we even see them have different body shapes and sizes to make them the most efficient at those tasks that they can be. At the most extreme, so this is where it gets really crazy. There are colonies of ants where you'll have two workers who are sisters, genetically the same, like could have the exact same genetic architecture, and one is 500 times bigger than a sister. That would be like if in a human family group, you'd have like one kid that was 5 feet tall and one kid that was 5,000 feet tall. I mean, it's just absolutely insane the degree of size. And you also have, you know, totally different jaws, like with army ants, you have these ants that have what we call tusks that are designed for cutting. I've had in the tropics, I've had them on me. They can cut right through your skin with no resistance, just whoosh, cut right through it.
And is that still just the regular typical ant mandibles that are just modified to be just your weapons instead of actual usable for food?
Yeah. So it's the same types of tissues, but it's just been totally changed morphologically to make it a maximized efficiency as a fighting ant, as a defensive ant, because that's its job within the colony.
Cool. I know we've talked about, you know, different degrees of sociality here. Mm-hmm. That reminds me a little bit of humans, where we specialize to do different tasks.
Sure. Yeah.
Are humans eusocial?
Oh man, that's a really spicy topic. Actually, in my social behavior seminar that I already alluded to, we read a paper that is about whether or not humans can meet the definition, of eusociality. The tricky part is that humans culturally vary so much, and even within a culture, there's so much variation in family structure. Right. If again, this defining characteristics are overlapping generations. There's definitely plenty of examples of human groups where you have multiple generations living together, but there's also examples of families where that's not the case. Right. You have the cooperative brood care. We certainly have many examples of human social structures where taking care of young is shared among different individuals. The really tricky one is the reproductive division of labor, where some individuals reproduce and others don't. But there actually is a controversial paper where someone argued that menopause has evolved to allow women to help take care of like their offspring's offspring or other related family members' offspring.
I have also heard things to that effect. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are some people that argue that humans might even meet our current definition of eusociality. But that's also where I'd go back to the issue I raised up front when I talked about the levels of sociality, where it's so invertebrate focused, because that's where it was first defined. That, you know, I'd argue maybe more we need to like think about how we define the levels of sociality more than argue about whether or not, you know, the function of menopause is
related to
cooperative brood care.
Awesome. So I guess those were most of the sort of talking points that I sort of wanted to hit. Do you have any cool ant information you'd like to tell the masses?
Oh, man. So many things. Trying to think about some of the ones. I was talking about the morphological caste variation, but I didn't mention that layer on top of that is age polyethism. So this is something that bees and ants both do. So it refers to the fact that as they age, they do different things. So what I'm trying to allude to is like how elegant and sophisticated the division of labor within an ant colony is. So you asked about like this, the morphological castes, which again, the idea that they have different sizes and different body morphologies to allow them to be most efficient at their tasks. Not only is that going on within an ant colony to make it be as efficient as working as a group as possible. But laid on top of that, you have the fact that they do different tasks at different ages to help maximize the fitness of the colony. The basic way it works for both ants and bees is when they're young, they do more tasks that are inside the nest. So things like taking care of babies, excavating the nest, taking care of the queen and feeding her. And then as they get older, they start going towards things like nest defense. And again, when you look at the really complex social groups of like the most sophisticated species of ants, where they're really, really highly evolved social structures, not only are the different morphologically different individuals doing different things at different ages, but they're all doing different things at different ages. And then as they get older, they go outside the nest because it's more dangerous and they're more likely to die. And the idea is it hurts the colony less if they die when they've already done all of those inside the nest tasks.
That makes sense.
And they're getting near to the end of their life anyways.
That makes sense. How often or how long does an ant live typically?
That's another crazy fact. Between weeks and years. So that's referring to workers. So I alluded to the fact too. Another thing to mention, Ant-Man is a horrible missed opportunity for a feminist film because ants are female. All of the worker ants are female. Males only exist for reproduction. They develop inside of their mother colony. Once they have matured enough, they go outside for the nuptial flight, which is when all of the reproductive individuals mate. The males just die, and then the females go start a new colony. But all of the workers, all of the ants, quote unquote, that you see outside a colony walking around without wings, they're all female. And so the workers, again, so the workers can live a few weeks to, there are some instances where it's been suggested they live for a couple years, which is really long for an invertebrate. There's this whole interesting aging thing with social insects. The crazy thing is the queens can live for well over a decade, which is insanely long for an animal that small that is an invertebrate.
Yeah.
Another crazy thing about that longevity is they have sperm. So they have the nuptial flight I've already mentioned. They do that before they start their new colony. They don't reproduce again. So termites, which are another eusocial insect, but they're actually, they're like cockroaches. They're very different than ants and bees.
Yeah.
They have males that live in the colony and they reproduce constantly. The ants somehow store sperm inside of themselves in a special organ called a spermatheca and somehow manage to keep it viable for over a decade. So there are people interested in like human fertility that study this, like how do ants magically keep sperm alive inside of themselves for, you know, 15 years?
Yeah, that was another question that I had sort of in my brain was, so the queen can sort of just decide to pop out a male whenever she wants?
Yeah, there's actually some really interesting studies about how there may be conflict between workers and queens about how many males versus females they want to have. I already mentioned that they're more related to their sisters than they are to their brothers. So the workers have an incentive to increase female reproduction, but the queens don't have the same incentive. So there's examples of potential conflict between a queen and her daughters about whether she should have more sons, more daughters, or an even mix, which is really interesting. But yes, somehow the queen can just not fertilize eggs by not depositing sperm from the spermatheca, and then that becomes a male.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense than what I was thinking in my head. Because their sex is determined differently than ours is.
Right. That so a female is a fertilized egg, a male is an unfertilized egg.
That makes so much more sense. We've talked about sex determination in various, you know, groups of animals a bit here and there, just in the different weird ways that different groups of animals do it. Again, mostly vertebrates is what we've talked about, but that makes much more sense. How often does the queen produce a nuptial pair to go out and make a new colony?
It's a seasonal thing. So usually they don't do it for years usually. So when a queen starts a new colony, she doesn't have enough resources and enough support in the colony to raise reproductive young. So it varies among species, but usually it's at least a couple years of growing into a bigger, more mature colony before they start reproducing alates. And then it's usually once a year seasonally. Depends on the species and what the triggers are. In Arizona, where I got my PhD, the leafcutter ants that live in the desert there, the mating flights are triggered by the monsoons. So when there's like a big heavy rain, that's when all of the reproductive individuals leave their colony to go have these nuptial flights and then start new colonies.
And is it, I assume, just because sheer numbers, I assume that there's more than one pair that comes out of each at a time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So reproduction for ants is a very much a numbers game. The colony failure rate is extremely high.
I'm sure.
So one of the frustrating things of being someone who works with ants in a lab is that they are kind of programmed to just die when they start a new colony. Because I think for leafcutter ants specifically, there's been some studies of some areas where it's like less than 0.5% of the new queens successfully start a colony. Like 99% of them die. And so, yeah, it's a very high failure rate. And so, yeah, they're trying to produce as many of these reproductive individuals as they can so that hopefully some of them are successful.
Yeah, that's very much the standard invertebrate strategy.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. And so I guess the thing that I want to end on was something that you had just sort of mentioned, was that we typically think, and in any piece of media that involves ants has this, where the queen is like absolutely dominant over the entire colony. They do whatever she says. It's almost like she's psychic and has like mind control over all the other ants in the colony. But you just mentioned that they have conflict potentially sometimes. Mm-hmm. So like what's the deal with that?
Well, so first of all, I groaned, I don't know if my mic caught it, in pain when you mentioned that, because that's actually just totally false. Queens are not in control of the colony. Like decision-making, all of that, not at all. People always say like, oh, I'd want to be the queen bee. No, you wouldn't. A queen bee sits in absolute dark and pumps out zillions of babies, and that's all she does. There are examples of ants where they produce hormones that stop workers from producing their own male offspring. So like there is a little bit of control in sort of that regard. But the really interesting, impressive thing about social insects is actually that they are very cognitively simple. They don't have complex brains that can make complex decisions. And yet, as a group, they can do incredibly complex things and solve complicated problems. So what's really cool is that they actually have very simple decision rules, but they work as a group to solve complex problems based on a number of different environmental factors. So using simple rules and simple communication and information from the environment, they can solve very complex problems. So they've actually become a really cool model for robotics. So like a lot of the...
Yeah, that's exactly what I was just thinking of when you were saying that, yeah.
There were people at Arizona State in the social insect group who were working with engineers, and there's even people who are also engineers that are using social insects. You know, we think like the future is going to be about, you know, these like nanobots, like little bunches instead of complicated robots, lots of simple robots that work together. And they're actually using ants and bees as the model for building algorithms for how simple decision-making devices can do complex things in coordination, because ants and bees have been doing it for millions of years.
Yeah.
But yeah, the queen is not in charge. That's a total lie.
So I guess how you said that they had like a simple set of rules that they use to make mm-hmm. their decisions. What are some of those rules or some examples?
So my favorite is what we call response thresholds. So this is a thing that my graduate advisor was known for studying, but a whole bunch of people in the world of ants as well. And that is where you can have division of labor and have different individuals perform different tasks by having them have different thresholds for stimuli. And the famous way that my graduate advisor developed to explain this, which is now how everyone explains it, is dirty dishes in the sink. So anyone's had roommates and shared a living space has probably had some conflict over dishes, where dishes build up in the sink. And the way it typically works is there's some person, like one roommate in the group, who gets triggered first. When there's like, you know, the dishes get to a certain level, they can't handle it and they wash them.
Sure.
And so that's what we call a response threshold. And so what works really great in a social setting is if different individuals have different response thresholds for different tasks. So one person gets bugged by dirty dishes first, but someone else gets bugged by the trash being needed to take out first. And, you know, another person has the lowest threshold for when the house needs to be swept. You can actually have this really well-synced, harmonious division of labor into everyone taking care of the different tasks by everyone just responding differently to the stimuli. So like, that's one example of actually a very simple, rule by which a group can divide a task to take care of all the different things that the group needs to do. For ants, it would be taking out the trash, because they actually do that as well, feeding the babies, building new tunnels, etc.
And is that something that's just like up to the, I get roughly personality of the individual ant? Or how is it? I'm sure there has been research done into like,
yeah,
why these thresholds are what they are or why they differ from individual to individual. But is it like a genetic thing, or is it just sort of a quirk that they have?
It is a genetic thing. And what's really cool is there's been some studies showing that increased genetic diversity makes that, gives you more variation in thresholds. So if you have more genetic diversity within a colony, usually by female mating with multiple males, that actually helps you have more different thresholds because of the genetic underpinning.
Interesting. Huh.
The personality of an ant, though, actually comes through the colony level, not the individual level, because I think a really cool last thing to talk about is the superorganism concept, which is the idea that, like, in an ant colony, the colony is the organism, not the individual ant.
Right. So
that's it's a really cool idea. Bert Holdobler and Neil Wilson, who I already mentioned before, were the ones that came up with this idea originally. And it's that ants have been under so much selective pressure evolutionarily for these high degrees of sociality that the colony is the functional unit, not any individual ant. So if you take a worker ant, we haven't mentioned this yet, most workers are actually sterile. They're female and they don't even have ovaries. So they are literally incapable of reproduction. And so it's not a functional animal in the way that, you know, an individual human is, for example, because it can't perform. Or even just
in terms of evolution.
Yeah.
That's not a functional animal.
Yeah, and they argue that the relevant vehicle of selection for ants is the colony, not the individual. So they've been this really interesting model for looking at sort of like new ideas about quote-unquote group selection that are not related to classical group selection. That's a whole separate can of worms probably should get into right now. But like the functional unit of selection is a colony of ants, because that's what functions as an animal, not the individual ants. I mean, there's even, you can't take the analogy too far, but what's cool is you can even think about it in terms of like the ants being like the different cells.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the queen is the gametic cells, the workers are the somatic cells. And so you even still have this sort of similar breakdown, but instead of it being cells within a single animal, it's the different animals within the social group.
Huh. Man, in invertebrates. and that's not even getting into, you know, what I tended to do more or a lot of when I was working on my master's was a lot of taxonomy. And it's like, I don't even want to bother with invertebrate taxonomy. There's just so many of them.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Well, awesome. I think that's a great place to leave it. Any last words of ante or social wisdom you'd like to impart on the listeners?
I guess because, you know, we talked about the invertebrate bias. Well, the vertebrate bias. Just don't overlook the little ones. They're very cool. They're all over the place. If you want to see, you know, fascinating, complex social structures in your backyard, ants are a lot more approachable than, you know, big, you know, lions or tigers. So
yeah,
always enjoy looking at them.
Absolutely. So thank you once again for joining us here, Nate. I really appreciate it, and I know Mike and Fia do as well. Where can the people find you if you would like to be found?
So I am kind of a recluse from social media, actually. but my email is available if you look me up on Bucknell's directory, and if you have any questions, I'm always happy to talk ants. So please feel free to send me an email and reach out.
Awesome. I never do the outro for the show. I kind of forget how it goes. This has been episode 134 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. I have been Gavin, that has been Nate, and we will see you all next time. Until then, take care, everybody. This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Finella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.